The serve, sliced, backhand return. Rafa with a backhand volley, and it's over. Game, set, and match. His third U.S. Open Men's Singles Championship.
Sloan from deep beyond the baseline plays a backhand. Keys a forehand. Sloan just hammering away. Now steps into a forehand. It hangs over. Forehand netted by Keys, and Sloan Stephens is the 2017 U.S. Open champion. A warm hug at the net between the two friends.
Here comes a big smile with Sloan. She can't believe it.
Welcome to episode 13 of Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. I'm Nick McCarville, and I'd like to tell you that I have the great honor right now of sitting inside. Maybe you'll hear a little bit of an echo. You might even hear a pin drop because I'm literally courtside at center court of Wimbledon as the championships have just wrapped up. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined today by Wimbledon.com's Lee Walsh. She's a tennis journalist, and she's helped oversee all the digital and .com workings of the website this fortnight. Lee, did you get any sleep these past 3 weeks?
not too much. No, but thanks for having me on the show, Nick. It's a pleasure to be here. And yeah, it's a strange day here at Wimbledon as you look across, you know, the empty center court and the grass, which is all brown around the baseline and the net posts. And it's all very quiet here. And it's kind of a time to reflect on everything that's gone by. And, you know, what a tournament we've had here over the last 2 weeks. So yeah, definitely some sleep to be had in the next week, that's for sure. But we'll do so with some great memories of what's gone these past couple of weeks.
Yeah, no, we have beautiful memories. Before we dive in, so what Lee and I are going to do is we're going to recap the Wimbledon that was. I felt like there was no one better to do it than with the woman that had her finger on the pulse of everything over these last 2 weeks here in London. But this episode 13, also includes a great interview by our very own Steve Flink with Tracy Austin. She's a two-time U.S. Open winner. I'm sure you know her voice well. She's a former world number one. She won that first U.S. Open when she was 16, which is crazy to think about. But that's to come in just a few minutes after Lee and I wrap up Wimbledon. And it is a compelling conversation, especially because Tracy recaps and recalls in great detail not only that U.S. Open run at 16 to the title, but her first U.S. Open when she was 14 in 1977.
Crazy to think now.
Yeah, it is. How tennis has changed so much, especially because of the ages. But before we go there, let's stay here at Wimbledon and center court. The biggest storylines, Lee, this was a Grand Slam that had a lot of upsets, especially in week one on the women's side, but on the men's side too. I think a lot of people had the great hope that Roger Federer was going to dance his way to a Wimbledon number nine. Serena Williams dropped just one set on her way to doing what a lot of people felt like was inevitable by getting to the final, but she countered that, saying that she had to work so hard to get into the final, where she lost to Angelique Kerber. We ended up with Novak Djokovic as our 2018 men's champion, but what were the big storylines for you from the tournament?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, pre-tournament, a lot of the talk was 10 years on from that Roger Rafa final in 2008, which many consider to be one of the greatest matches of all time. Could it possibly be that they'd get back to the Wimbledon final again? And there was so much buzz and reflection about that anniversary. And you kind of thought, could it be? And then when the draw was done, you know, they both had draws that were very workable in their favour, and you kind of felt more and more as they progressed that they were on collision course for a great date on July 15th. But yeah, it wasn't to be. But you look at the stories, and I think it really was the tournament of the upsets, particularly on the women's side. You know, we had the top 10 seeds falling before the quarterfinal, which is just unprecedented.
It's so mind-blowing.
It really, really is. And you look at, you know, Petra Kvitova came in with having won 5 titles this year and so much hope around her chances, and then suddenly she's out in the first round to Alexandra Sasnovich, and and then you've Garbiñe Muguruza out to Alison van Oefthonk out in the, you know, number 2 court, which is formerly known as the graveyard court here at Wimbledon. And we had Xue Shui knocking out Simona Halep again, and it was just, they kept coming that first week. And I think, you know, with all those upsets, I think we were quite fortunate to get the final we did with Angelique Kerber against Serena Williams, because it was two great stories and two comeback stories in a way of different types. And you know, you look at Angelique, and she had that amazing season, and then suddenly she slumped and she struggled to find her form and get back to that, and now she's won 3 of the 4 Grand Slams and is one away from a career major, and that's incredible. And then you look at Serena, and what she did is just, you know, we can often take these champions for granted. And you see with Novak and Serena too, that when they're winning, it's like you expect it. And I think what the two of them did over the past couple of weeks was just phenomenal. You know, Serena, you know, we've run out of superlatives to describe what she's been able to do, and she's added to her legacy once more by reaching a Wimbledon final within, you know, 10 months of having a child. And that was amazing. And then and Novak, you know, when he fell in the quarterfinals, I think, at Roland Garros, and, you know, he had that, you know, abrupt press conference, and
he
said,
very
frustrated. Very frustrated. He said, you know what, I don't even know if I'm going to play on the grass. And you fast forward, and suddenly here he is, champion again. And,
you know,
so the tournament of upsets, but also the tournament of the comebacks, really.
Yeah, it's interesting because every Grand Slam, every fortnight takes on its own, you know, its own chapters, its own stories. And for the first 10 days of the tournament, it really felt like the upsets were what drove the tournament. But then as we got into week two, we really did have some magical matches. You had Kevin Anderson overcoming Roger Federer 13-11 in the fifth set. You had Rafa and first Delpo 6-4 in the fifth, and probably one of the best fifth sets you're going to watch, at least in a compact 10 games. And then, of course, we had what ended up being the second longest Wimbledon match of all time, John Isner against Kevin Anderson. And then I think, too, the women's matches maybe didn't necessarily have the tremendous score lines as the men's, but if you dug in deep, Kerber-Kazakina was a tremendous match. Watching Serena Williams figure out how to beat a really inspired Camila Giorgi in the quarterfinals. And then just the brilliance of, I think you would agree too, Serena didn't play her best in the final, but watching the brilliance of Kerber and how solid she has made herself again, having been Australian and US Open champion 2 years ago, she figured out again how to play her best tennis. But it felt like, you know, maybe once we had Manic Monday, the tournament sort of kicked off into a second gear.
And you look at that men's quarterfinal day, you know, you touched on a couple of the matchups there with Anderson's upset from, you know, two sets down and match point down to Roger Federer. You know, that's just truly remarkable. And then we also had that day that the great Delpo-Rafa game. And it was a really unique experience here at Wimbledon because obviously the World Cup was running at the same time, and England were playing in the World Cup semi-final for the first time since 1990, which was obviously massive here. And they were looking to reach the final for the first time since 1966. So we had this incredible atmosphere around Wimbledon of, you know, one screen had the England-Croatia match on, and the other screen was Delpo-Rafa, and suddenly it's this like complete classic brewing on centre court, and you know, it finished with this amazing hug, and I think that was one thing, was almost the tournament of the hugs. We had, you know, Djokovic hugging his son Stefan, we had the Kerber-Serena hug after that. But yeah, so I think we'll look back on this tournament probably for those few great, that men's quarterfinals day, I think, was the day it truly sparked. And yet, you know, as you mentioned, the women had the storylines, and I think it's probably the first Grand Slam in quite a while that the men's draw was almost more captivating than the women's, because we've been blessed with so many great women's tournaments of late. So I think that Delpo, well, we thought that Delpo-Rafa match was one of the greatest ever seen, and then suddenly we've got the two longest semifinals in history. So the men's draw definitely threw up a lot of interesting contests, that's for sure.
Yeah, certainly. This year, obviously, on this podcast and at the US Open, we're celebrating 50 years of the Open era. And you got to do that here at Wimbledon as well. You guys dug out footage of Billie Jean King and Rod Laver winning the very first Wimbledon's and dancing together at the Champions Dinner, which is incredible. I want to ask you about that, but then also the anniversaries that we got to celebrate, 40 years since Martina Navratilova's first Wimbledon win, and also 20 years since the 1998 win of Yana Novotna, who sadly passed away in November. But celebrating those anniversaries, that's why we're doing this podcast this year, and why Steve Flink has been so brilliant of talking to all the great champions. But you here at Wimbledon were able to celebrate those anniversaries as well.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Billie Jean King and Rod Laver, and we had the fortune of sitting down with the two of them for a deep dive interview this year. And yeah, I saw the the footage of them dancing at the Champions Dinner in 1968 on the Wimbledon archive a few years ago, and I always wanted to talk to them about it and ask them about it. So the Wimbledon channel here that we have running throughout the championships interviewed them, and they both just spoke so highly of each other and the respect they have for each other, and it really was incredible. And then obviously we had Novak Djokovic and Angelique Kerber dancing at the Champions Dinner, so it was kind of this full circle of the 50 years. And yeah, the big anniversary for us here this year at Wimbledon was the 150th anniversary of the All England Club, which was originally founded as a croquet club, of course. So that was it's obviously a big part of this club is the history and the tradition, and we wanted to celebrate that in a unique way. So we did various things throughout. We've got had the players playing croquet.
You guys let me play croquet with the players. I think that was a mistake.
You did. You
it
did.
Was so fun, and it was cool to tell the players 150 years of the club, this is why we're playing croquet, and most of them had no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so that was going on. And you mentioned Jana Novotná there, and you know, Jana is somebody we hold extremely dear to our hearts here, not just at Wimbledon, but in the UK and around the world, really. Her triumph here in 1998, as we look out on centre court where it happened, was probably one of the most touching and emotive storylines we've seen in this great place. And she had lost, you know, she was 4-1 up and 40-15 up, I believe, in the third set against Steffi Graf.
1993.
And then she lost to Martina Hingis again in the next final, and we had this great moment when she lost to Steffi when the
Duchess of Kent.
That's right.
I gotcha.
It's because of the Duchess of Kent was on court presenting her with the runners-up trophy, and it was just this extraordinary human moment where she just started crying on the Duchess's shoulder, and that's something that will always be remembered by fans of Wimbledon, and to see her come back and be presented with the Duchess and keep that date with destiny, because the Duchess told her, you know, you'll come back here, you'll win this, and she did, and for it to be the 20-year anniversary of that, and to also see Barbara Krejcikova and Katerina Siniaková winning the doubles title this year, and Barbara had been coached by Jana Novotná, and she said after they won Roland Garros that one of the last things Jana had ever said to her was go win a Grand Slam, and that was an incredible storyline as well.
Barbara Krejcikova has two of them, French Open and Wimbledon,
and they're the first team here to win both the juniors and senior titles.
Wow, and I think the first doubles team, at least on the women's side, to win the French Wimbledon double in 15 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah, incredible.
Yeah, it's just so wonderful. And we're going to get to Steve Flink's conversation here with Tracy Austin in just a minute. But Lee Walsh from Wimbledon.com is so poetically putting. I just love, and we're also, I want to say, we're looking out over a pristine Wimbledon. I was ready for, or it was pristine center court. I was ready for all sorts of construction vans and people taking things down. That is happening around the grounds. But literally, there's just a single security guard watching over center court. I hope he's having a good day.
It is a nice place to come in and kind of reflect on what's come before, and it does have this almost surreal feel to us that it's done for another year and another chapter has been added to the great story of this tournament and this place, and we'll just see what lies ahead in the US Open, obviously.
Yeah, totally. Well, we're about to turn our attention to the US Open series, of course, that kicks off in Atlanta and San Jose in the coming weeks. But Novak Djokovic, champion again, a great run for Kevin Anderson to beat Roger Federer, as you mentioned, save a match point, and then win that historic match over John Isner, 6 hours, 36 minutes, that semifinal. Disappointment, I think, for Rafael Nadal, having played such an incredible quarterfinal against Del Potro, and then really did play a wonderful semi against Novak, losing 10-8 in the fifth set, and then just a lot of names to watch. I mentioned Kazatkina, Yelena Ostapenko, Stefanos Tsitsipas. Mm-hmm. There's the young American, Mackenzie McDonald, who had a nice run into the fourth round. But as we wrap up our chat, what were the big things on social media or the big things for Wimbledon.com? You put out so much content.
Yeah.
But what were a couple that stood out for you?
I'm just trying to think now. Well, it's a funny one, really. But one person who always captures the imagination at Wimbledon every year is Mansur Bahrami in the Legends doubles, and we always laugh. It never ceases to amaze us the amount of interest in what he does. And you'll see it in the grounds. People will be rushing past you to get to his court to watch him. But we had a lot of our celebrations across social media, and the build up was based around the 150th anniversary of the club and our Take on History campaign. But in terms of the kind of the biggest, the most engaged with content. You look at, you know, Novak Djokovic hugging his son in that, in
so
that touching
cute
moment, in the bowels of center court after that final. That went incredibly well. We had the Duchesses here, the Duchess of Cambridge and Sussex, in their first kind of outing together as, mm-hmm, as sister-in-laws, which obviously garnered a lot of attention.
Yes, sons, the Dukes.
Yes, yes, exactly. And then it's, of course, you know, the hot shots and the great moments, yeah, and the hugs. And it's all those emotive moments that people really engage with and connect with. And that's the thing, you know, you can plan as much as you can or want or need to for these tournaments. But ultimately, it's the storylines that steer you. And it's the players that create these moments. And it, for us, it's just about, you know, doing them justice across our platforms. And hopefully we did that.
Yeah, no, I think you did. Job well done. Thanks for chatting with me about the Wimbledon that was, and only, what, 49 weeks until qualifying gets underway at Roehampton.
Well,
next
we have
year.
We have a line here: when we finish, we begin. So the list has already started ahead of next year.
Oh, well, if you missed any of what Lee mentioned, of course, go to Wimbledon.com. You can see all of their great coverage on the website and on social media. But thank you for joining me on Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open.
Thank you, Nick.
All right, well, let's now turn to Steve Flink's chat with Tracy Austin. As I mentioned, she's a two-time U.S. Open champion and former world number one. The Hall of Famer now is a well-respected tennis commentator. And here in this conversation with Steve, she looks back at her storied run at the U.S. Open in 1979 and also so much more in compelling detail. Here's Steve with Tracy Austin.
As we continue to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Open Tennis and the U.S. Open, our guest today was a prolific achiever in the world of tennis who established herself as a great player and eventually landed deservedly in the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Tracy Austin grew up on the hard courts of California and became a two-time U.S. Open champion. In 1980, she reached number one in the world on the WTA computer. She won a Wimbledon mixed doubles championship with her brother John. Tracy was described by one authority when she was at her peak as having the presence of mind and ability to change tactics in the middle of a match, and it was uncanny. Her career was brief but unmistakably brilliant. Welcome, Tracy, to this podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Absolutely, Steve.
Now, Tracy, let's go back, if you would, to 1977, and you came to New York at 14 for your first U.S. Open, and here is how you were described by Julie Heldman in World Tennis Magazine. As you know, Julie was an accomplished player who was ranked second in the U.S. and top 10 in the world. And she said of you, and I quote, "The kid's great tennis talent and her on-court charm would make her a favorite anywhere. But with her ponytails, braces, and pinafores, which make her look about age 10, anyone who clapped against her would be reported to the Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Children. She looks like a natural successor to the current champ, Chris Evert." How does that assessment sound to you now, Tracy?
Well, looking back, I was awfully young. I was, you know, 14, and that's just who I was. I was a fully engaged tennis player. I was enjoying myself. I was tiny. I was probably about 5 feet tall, probably 90 pounds. So I was not very mature physically yet. Not that I ever became a large person, but yeah, I mean, I was gangly. I was still growing, so I was playing against players that were a foot taller than I was. But on the court, mentally, emotionally, I was very mature. I could handle the emotions. I could handle the nerves, the situations, the big moments didn't overwhelm me. So in that way, I was well beyond my years. But you get me off the tennis court, and I was giggly, you know, not a lot of long sentences, just a regular kid that was living a dream.
Yeah, that's certainly the way I remember it, Tracy. But let's talk about what a spectacular debut you made at foursomes that year. Starting with that first round match, you had a three-setter, I don't know if you remember, with Heidi Eisterliner. What do you remember about that? Because that was a tough start.
Yeah, it was an outside court. I remember the clay at Forest Hills, obviously. Well, first of all, Forest Hills was such a historic site, and I had heard of it. My older brother Jeff and my sister Pam had played there. So walking in, you felt that it was a special moment going into the locker room. But Heidi Eisterliner from Germany, very experienced and coming off the junior nationals all summer long. So, you know, playing against a woman who was crafty and smart and on clay, which I hadn't played a lot on. I don't remember specifics about the match, but I do remember winning and moving on an outside court, my family being there. That's kind of what I remember.
Yeah, fair enough. But then, of course, I bet you do remember a little bit more vividly coming up against Sue Barker, who was the number four seed, had been a Wimbledon semifinalist. Big forehand, sort of like a forerunner for the way a lot of players play today, using that inside-out forehand. How did you beat her so comfortably?
Yeah, it's so interesting because looking back, I didn't really, there wasn't social media, so there wasn't a whole hullabaloo about Tracy's playing, Sue Barker, and she's four in the world. And I just went out there and knew what I had to employ, the strategy that I had to employ. Sue had a huge forehand, as you said, especially inside out. So it was going to be about depth. It was going to be about trying to get to her backhand, find her backhand, run her to her forehand to get to the backhand. Looking back now, I work with Sue at BBC, so it's kind of strange to think about a match like that and what pressure she must have felt playing a 14-year-old. I'm sure that didn't help her because back home we know that the tabloids and the English press can be very difficult on top English players. And so for her to go out there, there was a lot more to lose than to gain. So for me, at 14, I was very good at, again, just putting my head down, going out there, being consistent, moved real well. Nerves probably got her a bit, and again, mentally, I was a giant out there for that age.
So you actually liked stepping up to that challenge, didn't you? You were certainly not apprehensive, or it didn't appear to be.
No, and I think that's something that is always going to be important for an athlete, is that they love the battle. I mean, if they shy away from that, boy, you can start to really have emotional problems and. You're not going to look forward to that situation. For me, I had everything to gain. I had played, as I said, probably 8 weeks of junior tournaments all summer. So for me, this was a kid in a candy store. Now I get to play. What an opportunity to play and test my game against someone who's four in the world. Nothing to lose. Go out there, compete as hard as I can. I was in a great place staying with a family in Long Island, so I was very happy. As I said, most of my family there. Can't get better than that type of a situation for me. And for Sue, it probably couldn't have been worse than playing a kid who, was just playing so freely.
So, Tracy, coming off that triumph, now you met Virginia Ruzic of Romania, who, of course, would win the French the following year. In some ways, don't you think the Barker match was good preparation for Ruzic, who also built her game around a big forehand?
Absolutely. Virgie had a massive forehand at the time, and topspin, so a topspin forehand. Sue's was very flat, so that
was
a bit different. And also, I feel like Ruzic had a little bit more versatility. She had the drop shots, she had the lobs, the slices, the topspin angles. So that was a bit more tricky. Sue was a little bit more straightforward and linear in the way that she played. But Virginia Ruzic was a grinder. She moved extremely well on the surface, slid well, felt like she grew up on clay, and so that was the surface that she preferred. So I knew going out that was going to be not only a physically demanding match, but a mentally demanding match as far as staying patient. The points were not going to come easy. They would be long points, and I was really going to be taxed. I got to say, I don't remember the score, whether it was two or three sets, but I know that to follow up and not have a letdown after beating Sue was huge to continue to and maintain that concentration and focus.
So, Tracy, that put you into the quarterfinals, which was an excellent excellent showing from you. And you had to play Betty Stova, the Netherlands, who was, of course, she was only about a foot taller than you. Now, your brother said that the difference was that Betty just out-bigged you, because she was just so much taller and stronger. Would you agree with that? Was that essentially what it came down to? She was so strong, big hitter, flat shots, explosive player, but no, you couldn't get any rhythm against her. Would you agree with that?
100%. Betty was 6 feet, 6 foot one. As I said, I was 5 feet tall. Betty just came out, big serves, booming ground strokes, finishing points off at the net. I just did not have enough power. I didn't have enough strength to be problematic for Betty. So it was for a relatively quick match and overwhelming match. But at that stage, I had done my best. I don't think that I was really disappointed because I was never really in the match. She was just too physically strong, and I knew that was something that I couldn't overcome. So I was still extremely pleased. I mean, getting to the quarters as a 14-year-old, battling for, you know, I think at the stage when you're trying to make that transition onto the pro tour, you have a lot of doubts as to where your game fits up, how you fit mentally, what you need to work on when you're playing against the top players. So there were a lot of answers that I got from that U.S. Open and a lot of confidence. Overall, it was just a complete win-win for me. Betty was just way too good that day.
So you described it to a great degree what I was going to ask you next anyway, but put that debut in perspective. And looking back, did you exceed your expectations, or was that pretty much what you thought you might be able to do coming into the U.S. Open?
Yeah, I can't remember having expectations. I kind of went into every tournament just going match by match, never really looking forward deep into the draw and saying who I might play here. But I would say, looking back at the end of the tournament, without a doubt, I would have exceeded expectations with, you know, given my, lack of physicality that I had at that stage. I think I was extremely pleased with that result.
So, Tracy, the tournament moved to Flushing Meadows in 78, from Hartrue over to the hard courts and from a private club to a big facility, public facility. How'd you feel about the move at the time, and how would you compare and contrast the experiences of the setting at Forest Hills to this brave new world at Flushing Meadows?
I'm extremely ecstatic that I got to play at least one time at Forest Hills, just to feel that history, to soak that up with walking past the grass courts onto clay courts, you know, the different surface, a club-like feel where I still go back today a couple times each summer during the U.S. Open, and it's still the same locker room, and it's got the bar and the clubhouse, and you got the pictures of all of the past champions up on the wall, the wood. You really has a little bit of like a mini Wimbledon feel. And
right,
the neighborhood as well, where literally my mom would drop me off at the front gates. I would take my racket and my bag in, and she'd have to go find a parking spot in the neighborhood, which is incredible to think about now at a Grand Slam. That just wouldn't be, doable. But then I think it was appropriate to move to Flushing Meadows. It had outgrown Forest Hills. And to move to hard court, which I preferred. I grew up on hard courts in California, so I liked that surface. Everything was just bigger. The locker rooms were bigger. There was plenty of room. There were plenty of practice courts, easy parking. I thought it was an appropriate time, and I grew to love Flushing Meadows and feel very comfortable. Obviously, over the years, every year they make new innovations and new remodels, and they're always improving. But I think the U.S. Open was an appropriate time to move because it had outgrown Forest Hills.
And was it a big eye opener when you first walked into the place? You remember your first impressions at Flushing Meadows that year?
I don't know. I mean, it's funny because I don't really take all that stuff in. Doesn't really overwhelm me. I'm just kind of what is, and I just take it in immediately and adjust. It didn't feel daunting. What's kind of funny is now at my age, looking back, I was talking to my husband about this last night. I sometimes don't even, it feels like a different life. I don't know how I dealt with all of that at such a young age. I have three boys myself, and my youngest is actually older than I was at the time. And just to think of them going through all of what I did, and just the press and the pressure and the playing big matches in front of people, I kind of took it all in stride, and I think that was helpful because I really, it didn't feel big time to me. I just was concentrated on whether I could win or not, and what strategy I was going to employ. So I think that was healthy to be almost naive about it and have that attitude.
Well, single-minded as well, right? You just were thinking about what you had to do at that moment.
Yes, very much so, very focused, and didn't get distracted easily, and that was very helpful. For a young age, I pretty much had that concentration level. As you know, Steve, that was probably my best asset.
Absolutely, no question about that, Tracy. But now, in that first Open at Flushing, onto the hard courts that you said that you preferred, you were seated fifth, and you upheld that seating before losing to Chrissy Evert. How did you feel about your showing at 15 there on the hard courts?
I think 15, getting to the quarters, I was, again, very pleased. Again, going in against Chrissy, I felt like she was just a little stronger physically than I was, and that was the difference. We had a very similar game, but she had, at that time, a little bit more power, a little bit more experience. And so, yeah, I think I was making progress. And I, at that time, I think that's what you're looking for, is to every year, every 6 months, kind of judge where you were in the recent past and feel like you're going in the right direction. And I felt like I was getting stronger. My game was improving. The confidence level was building. My ranking was moving up. So everything was going in the right direction. Lost to Chrissy, went back to school the next week. Everything was cool.
So then, Tracy, we come to the what was a golden moment for you in 1979. And you had, talk about making progress, you really made substantial progress in 79. You ended Chrissy's 125-match winning streak on clay in Rome in a third-set tiebreaker. You'd beaten Martina Navratilova. You really were going strong, and you were seeded third. So how did you feel coming into that tournament, you know what, I might be able to pull this off. I might be ready for this.
I think in the back of my mind, it was there. The fact that, yeah, sure, why can't I win this? I've beaten Martina. I've beaten Chrissy on big stages. I've beaten Chrissy at Madison Square Garden. And as you said, the huge match in Rome that was, I think, over 3 hours and such an incredible battle physically and mentally. You look at pictures.
And by the way, you were down 4-2 in the third in that match, and it was quite a comeback.
I know. That was a mental battle there. You look at pictures from the time 78 to 79, and I was a completely different person. I was more a little girl at 15, and more starting to move towards a woman and stronger. And I'd spent the year also in the gym. And funny enough, because at the time it wasn't quote cool to lift weights, and so I lifted weights at a friend's house. Didn't really tell anybody because it wasn't cool to have bigger muscles. But I was starting to put more muscle mass on.
That was the first year, Tracy, that you did that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I think that made the difference. My ball had a little more heft on it. I had more endurance as well for longer matches. I just felt like I was more on equal footing physically to Chrissy by that time. Had some wins against Chrissy and Martina. So sure, it was at that point going to be about who played better on the day and more than just the physicality of it.
So Tracy, the great glory was at the end against Martina and Chrissy, but let's not move past the Kathy Jordan match, which was so critical for you in the round of 16 when you were down 5-6, 15-30 in the final set, 2 points from losing. Talk about the difficulty of that match and what made Kathy Jordan so tough as an attacking player who put you under constant pressure.
Yeah, there were so many attacking players in that era where serve and volley, chip and charge, that heavy, heavy slice, and they'd come forward and you have to thread the needle with the passing shot. So that was typical. But Kathy was a phenomenal athlete. She had a kick serve, which would get up on the two-hander. It wasn't necessarily a powerful serve, but she was very quick and cat-like around the net. Tough to lob because, again, she was such an incredible athlete. Yeah, there are certain days where you feel a little bit off. I felt that I wasn't hitting the ball quite as cleanly that day, I remember clearly. So it was just going to be about trying to dig in. And she was problematic with the way that she was using so much variety on her forehand and the slice backhand, the drop shot coming in. There wasn't a lot of rhythm to be had when you played against Kathy Jordan. And when you feel a little off, that was difficult. I remember the 15-30 point to this day, which is kind of incredible because there are so many matches where I can't even remember the score or even my head-to-head against players, but for some reason I remember that point. If I'm correct, she kicked the serve out to my backhand. I hit a winner cross-court passing shot when she was serving and volleying. That was clearly a critical moment because she would have gone up match point, a couple of match points. So dug my way out of that match just by sheer guts and hanging with it and staying positive. It's sometimes in matches you feel like your opponent is tough, but also you're fighting against yourself as well. And that was one of those days where you just had to be patient and not too self-critical.
And she was kind of fearless, would you say?
Absolutely fearless. She was ultra aggressive. She knew that if we got into long rallies at the baseline, the advantage would swing my way. So the best opportunity for Kathy was to get to the net. You know, the sooner that she could get to the net, the more time she could spend in the forecourt, the better off she would be.
So Tracy, you won that in the final set tiebreak and won your next match, and then there you were in the semis against Martina Navratilova. First set, 5-all, love 40, would be
love
probably
40, my serve?
Yes, probably the pivotal game of the match, and you end up winning 7-5, 7-5. How clearly do you remember that one?
Clearly, I don't. I didn't know that I was. So, you know what's funny is that now that I play some of the, you know, legend events at the majors, every point, so often I'm thinking about what happened 2 or 3 points ago, and why didn't I do this, or why didn't I try that, or, you know, my mind is on the wrong things, and instead of clearly thinking forward, which is what you have to do. I think that was one of my best assets, as we talked about before, was my mental toughness, my ability to stay in the moment. And that's an example where at Love 40, I probably wasn't thinking about losing the game. I was thinking about how can I win this next point, not 3 points from now, or I need 3 points to get to deuce. And that was the beauty of it. So against Martina, obviously, again, she's an attacking player. She wants to be at the net. If we were both at the baseline, I was going to hit predominantly to her backhand and deep, because if I hit it short, she was going to chip that nasty slice that she has and come forward, and she'd be tough to pass. She would be tough to lob. So with Martina, it was all about whether she could get to the net first and how accurate my passing shots were be, and then also how much that I could keep her at the backcourt when it's my serve. My first serve was critical because my second serve sometimes could be attackable, and I would serve and she would chip and charge, and already she was at the net and I had to contend with her.
So that was a really significant win, Tracy, to get you into your first major final. Now you're playing Chrissy in the final, and she's won 31 matches in a row at the Open, had won four, was going for her fifth title in a row, and had beaten you in Mahwah just a few weeks before. The two of you had an interesting year because, as you mentioned, you beat her in Madison Square Garden, you beat her in Rome. She won the Mahwah match. It was a question, I guess, at that time of who was better on the day, as you said earlier. So what were your thoughts coming into this final? How much pressure did you feel to try to take the title away from Chrissy?
Yeah, zero pressure. I mean, that's not a word I would use with that final at all. I felt like opportunity. I think, you know, you can look at pressure to me is negative and opportunity is positive. I felt I'm 16. I know she's won it a bunch of times. Again, with the lack of social media, I didn't know how many times. I did not know that I would be the youngest champion ever, beating, I think, Maureen Conley's record. Those are kind of things that I think are important because those are facts that aren't necessary going onto the court. All I knew was that I was going to wake up, I was going to have my warm-up on the backyard court of the family that I was staying with. My mom would drive us in. My brother would be there. He promised if I beat Martina in the semis, he'd fly in. This is Jeff. So he was there. You know, I was very relaxed, doing tongue twisters on the way. I didn't feel pressure. I'm sure Chrissy did. She was 24. I'm 16. I'm the kid coming up with this very similar style of play that she had, very similar mentality that she had. I just went out there with the thought of how am I going to win this match? What do I need to do?
What was the key? Because it was 6-4, 6-3. It was a fairly decisive triumph. And what do you think?
I don't think that's decisive.
Well, two hard-fought sets, yes. But I'm saying it wasn't 7-6 in the third like Rome. It wasn't one of those matches. And you seem to have the upper hand most of the way. What do you think was the determining factor?
I think so much of it is like a chess match when you're playing against Chrissy. It's who's going to hit with a little bit more power, a little bit more penetration, who's going to have more depth, you know, who's going to be able to get a shorter ball to create the opening, maybe open the court with an angle, you know, things like that. First service percentage, although neither of our serves were big, but if you had second serves, the other player, Chrissy or myself, would be able to, you know, get their opponent moving. So it's every point you knew when you woke up and you had to play against Chrissy, you knew that there were going to be almost zero free points. She wasn't going to give you many cheap mistakes, so you had to work for it. You knew that you were going to have to mentally be very strong. You're going to have to be patient in points, but yet alert to look for any opening to go a little bit bigger. So obviously we were playing with wood rackets at the time, so you don't have that power to just hit through your opponent like you do today. You needed combination of shots, 2-3 shots to outmaneuver your opponent to get the opening.
So elaborate a little bit, Tracy, because it was such an important win and such a chess match on the tennis court, as you describe. But you and Chrissy were always described as mirror images of each other, and both so consistent from the baseline, so much strategic acumen, percentage players, the mental toughness extraordinary on both ends of the court. How did you feel about that comparison, and how would you describe maybe a few of the differences between the two of you as great champions?
Gosh, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I don't know that there were a whole ton of differences. I think, you know, at the peak, when I was able to beat Chrissy five times, I was maybe hitting a little bit harder, but she had a great drop shot that I did not have. So, you know, the athleticism, I don't know, very, very similar. Maybe I'm a tiny bit quicker, but she has other assets that, you know, that mental toughness, she's clearly incredible, her longevity. So I think just going back to the basics of the consistency, the accuracy, the mental toughness, those overall big concepts are very similar. And I don't know, I should ask you that question because you've seen us play so much. I don't know that there's a whole ton of differences.
No, I think you're right. I think you described it very accurately. But Tracy, how long did it take for that win to sink in? I mean, that was an incredible moment in your life to become the youngest winner among the women at the U.S. Open and the U.S. Championships, for that matter, as well. So how long afterwards did it, before it really dawned on you what you had just accomplished?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, because I think I didn't know, and I was a little naive as to how it would change my life, which I think it was helpful, because if I had known what a big deal it actually was, I would have felt more pressure, as you said. I would have felt that, oh my gosh, this is such a huge moment. I really honestly felt like I just want to beat Chrissy today. I just want to win this match, and wasn't thinking big picture, and I wasn't thinking macro, whereas the next day, all of a sudden, you know, so much more press and so many more endorsements were coming my way, not immediately, but, you felt that surge of interest, I guess. There was interest before, but there was more interest. I was on the cover of Sports Illustrated the next week, going on all of the major Good Morning America, Today Show, those types of things. But I think the most important thing is that as a little girl, you always want to try to become number one in the world and win a major. Well, at a young age, I achieved that goal of winning a major, and no one could ever take that away from me. I was very appreciative that it happened so soon. You know, you could kind of check that box off, because your life does change. You're kind of in a different group as soon as you win one major.
So Tracy, is it true that you actually went to McDonald's after that match in your tennis? I remember hearing about that at the time and just shaking my head. With some family members, you went into McDonald's on your way to the airport still in tennis attire. Is that true?
That's 100% true. It didn't feel like a big deal at all. What happened was my brother Jeff was in law school at UCLA. He played on the tour, and he was really, besides my mom, probably my biggest backer, my biggest supporter, and we practiced all summer long. He might be the reason, actually, why I won that match in Rome when I was down 4-2 in the third. I thought, oh my gosh, Jeff's worked so hard with me. If I could win this match, he'd be so happy. So it's amazing how a thought like that can just give you that extra boost of energy when I was so tired to help me win that semifinal match at the Italian. And then it was Jeff who I said, can you please come? If I win against Martina, can you please come and watch the final? And somehow he must have been busy, or it must have been in school. I think it was on a Friday. I beat Martina. I called him up. I said, I won. You have to make the trip. And he's like, you won already? He wasn't aware that I had won. And so he flew in to watch the final, and we had to take him back to the airport after the press to catch his flight. So I was still in my dress. We grabbed the car and dropped him off at the airport. Then my mom and I, we were starving, so we went through McDonald's. So it wasn't a big deal. You know, now it's so much more of a big deal when people win the title and they take the pictures with the trophy and they get dressed up. Back then it was they hand you the trophy, you do the press conference, and you move on.
And were you greeted? Did people in the McDonald's come up to you and congratulate you, or were you pretty much left alone?
I think we went through the drive-through, and the guy's like, didn't you just win the U.S. Open? So, yeah, it was, but I didn't think it was weird. It was just something we had to do. We were hungry.
Now, Tracy, it's always hard to defend a major, and you went back in 1980, and you detained the number one world ranking by then. and you got to the semis, and you and Chrissy played. It was a little drizzle at the start of the match. There was some thought that maybe it would have to be stopped, but you got off to a big start. We're up 4-love. Eventually won the first set 6-4 before she came back to win the last two 6-1, 6-1. Talk about that experience. Was it the weight of defending? Was it the quality of her performance? How did you feel about it from your standpoint?
Yeah, I think Chrissy played amazing. I mean, I think she's spoken about how important that match was for her, because I believe going into that match, I had beaten her five times.
Yes, you had, because after the Open, you beat her later on in the fall, and then a couple more in January. Yeah, it was all in a string between the U.S. Open and very early in 1980, and now you were playing for the first time in many months.
Yeah, I beat her three times in 11 days at the beginning of 1980, so yep. That's when I think she took 3 months off. So, yeah, no, this was a huge match. I think it was obviously very, very important. I think it was hot. Was it really hot? I can't.
Well, it became hot. You know, it started off, you played 11 in the morning, and the skies were kind of gray. It was muggy, and it started to drizzle. And I still remember you kind of rubbing your foot on the court, because there was some sense that maybe it was dangerous on the slick, hard courts to play in that drizzle. Then, as the match unfolded, it got brighter and warmer.
So, yeah, I think I started out strong. Chrissy, I think, decided to play a little bit more aggressively. I had a hamstring pull in the summer right before the Open. So I think, to tell you the truth, she played phenomenal, and I ran out of gas in the third set. So my fitness level was not where it needed to be, and she...
Your training on the way to the Open had been impaired. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I think she came out with more of an aggressive mindset, and it paid off for her.
So, Tracy, a year later, you come back, and that was an interesting tournament, because Martina Navratilova got to the finals, and she had beaten Chrissy, and there you were playing Martina in the final. And it was one of the more uplifting victories of your career, one of the gutsiest, because you lost the first set 6-1 and then you came back to win in two tiebreakers. Talk about the roller coaster ride of that match and what enabled you to beat a very inspired Martina in the final round for your second U.S. Open triumph.
Yeah, the backstory of that was more of a roller coaster, because, as you know, at the beginning of 1981, I was out with a back injury. Beginning of 1980, I had the same back injury and was able to get over it. That occurred again at the beginning of 1981.
Yeah.
I was out until May. So January until May, I was out 5 months. And people were already starting to write me off, which is understandable. You know, that's a long time for someone to be out. So coming back, I played with discomfort for the first month. It wasn't completely better yet. And so by the time I was getting to the summer and Wimbledon, and then through the summer and building up to the U.S. Open, I was starting to get my strength back, which I needed. I'm 5'4.5", so I'm playing against players that are bigger. I need to have all of my physicality back. And I started to get that back. But I also remember I had to get my confidence back, because you're out for a long time. I had a couple of losses that I wasn't used to having on my comeback. So I kind of equate that to the finals as well, because the first set against Martina, we had waited a long time. The men's match before us extended from three sets, and it went to four, then it went to five. You know, the nerves start to build. I'm 18. I'm a little bit more aware of what's on the line when you're playing a Grand Slam final. I was naive at 16. Now I'm not as naive. I know how important this is. My nerves were completely shot that first set. Martina was just in that mode where she smothered you. You know, big serve, incredible athleticism, covering the net, covering the lobs. Just didn't feel like I could get in any points and make an impact. She was just too aggressive with the first and second shots. Well, I felt I was always on my back foot. So I had to figure out, how am I going to solve this? And that's where I kind of credit my mental attitude of staying positive. And it was windy as well. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, I do. I do.
It was very well. Very gusty. So I was, okay, I'm just lost the first set, what felt like 10 minutes. I could either, you know, just hide in a hole and get off this court quickly, or I'm just going to keep probing and poking and trying to lengthen points and keep her at the baseline. And Martina got a little tight. She missed a few forehand volleys by just keeping extra balls in play. you know, she started swatting the balls out, you know, against the backdrop. She was seemed to be mad at the umpire. She seemed to be agitated, and I noticed that, and that was helpful to me. For me to realize, wow, looking up at the scoreboard, I'm down, and yet she seems to be the one agitated. I'm going to try to use this positively and just keep my head down, keep plugging away. And it helped, because in that second set, I won 7-6. And then in the third set, what's funny is that I believe I had a match point before the tie break that I didn't get, because my brother John called me about a year ago, and he said, Tracy, I'm watching this match. Are you sure, jokingly, are you sure you won this match? Because you just had match point, which 25, whatever number of years later, I was unaware that I had a match point and didn't get it. So again, that's how I played point by point. If I had to play that match today and didn't, you know, convert that match point, that's all I would be thinking about. So I moved on into the tiebreak.
But that's just it, Tracy. Let me just interrupt. So you go to the tiebreak. That should have worked against you. But you ran away with that tiebreak, and it wasn't the key that you're hitting, you're going for the forehand down the line, which was one of your best shots and which caught Martina off guard because you swept through that last tiebreak.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've watched that tiebreak a couple of times, and, you know, it's Martina and I, during a rain delay for Tennis Channel 4 or 5 years back, we covered that tiebreak, and Martina said, your mom must have told you to go down the line, or Robert Lansdorp must have told you to go down the line, which I was so insulted that she would think that somebody would tell me. I would have been so upset if somebody would try at that stage of a match, and no one ever in my career would tell me, you know, give me advice on the court, because I just felt like I had to feel it, you know, feel that opening, feel that change. And I said, Martina, are you kidding me? If anybody had said anything to me at that point or ever, I would have told them to please leave. I just thought it was funny that she all these years thought somebody had told me to change my strategy. But as you know, Steve, it was all about keeping it to the backhand, because the backhand on a scale of 1 to 10 was a 5, and the forehand was an 8 or a 9. You're clearly going to go to the backhand more frequently.
Yeah, it's interesting because Chrissy played her pretty much the way you did. That's interesting that you say that, because you really did have to pummel away at her backhand, right?
You had to pummel away at her backhand and try to get something short and look for the opening and then go to the forehand. Well, that's what happened, is that I noticed that there was a huge opening. She was trying to cover her backhand a little bit more, and so the opening was on the forehand side. So I think three of the first 5 or 6 points I had a winner on that down the line forehand, and that really set the tone for that third set tiebreak, which I just saying the word third set tiebreak, you know, Grand Slam final right now would make me hyperventilate. And at the time, it was all about next point. That's all I could think about, which was very helpful.
Tracy, you think that the Open has it right? I've always felt the Open has it right, in the sense that why did it change the rules for the final set? The other three majors play out the final set, and obviously you're aware, you remember the famous Isner-Mahut 70-68 in the fifth set, and they played 7 sets in 1. But to me, I've always been in favor of that final set tie, but that the Open stands out to me for that reason. How did you feel about it as a player, and how do you feel about it as a viewer now?
Yeah, I like it. I think someone like a John Isner has no chance the next match that he plays. And so I think that's important. I think at some point there needs to be a time where the match is going to come to a conclusion. Now, whether Wimbledon changed it where it was 9-all in the fifth or something, but I think just to go on endlessly like that, the next round, as we saw with John Isner, he had so many blisters and his body was so racked that there was nothing that he could bring to that next match.
So, Tracy, you said afterwards that that second title meant more to you at the Open than the first, in the sense that the first one happened so fast. You still feel that way?
I do. I think I had to almost work harder physically to come back from the injury, the back injury, and then mentally to come back to regain my confidence. And then the way that the match went in the final, where Martina had such a huge lead. This, not only the score line, but the way that it was, she was just destroying me, basically. And somehow to be able to work my way back into that match and even make it close was something that I was proud of.
So, Tracy, by the next year, I mean, you've described very well what you went through in 80 and 81 with your back. And by the next year, You played your last Open in 82. You played your last, what looked like would be your last majors in 83. And your back was really becoming a more and more serious problem. How distressing was it to be not yet 21 and finding your career seemingly coming to an end? That must have been very, very frustrating and saddening.
Absolutely. I think those are two perfect words to sum it up. To be so young and to not be even competing at the majors, it was very difficult. And when you look back at what I had been doing my whole life, was going towards goals, always moving forward, always looking to improve, always playing tennis basically every day. Now, all of a sudden, even that winter of 1981, there was so much time that I spent in bed and so much time I was trying to recover. Now, move forward to today, and there is so much more that could have been done. Sports medicine is so much, everybody's so much smarter as to how to deal with injuries. I went to 5 different doctors. They had 5 different ways of therapy and how to treat things. So the knowledge was just not quite there as the way it is today. So yes, it was a very, very difficult time to, I feel like, have my career taken away at such a young age.
And Tracy, it's hard for you to talk about it in this fashion the way I might, but might we have had a situation back then with you in your 20s playing against Chrissy and Martina for a long time to come and then all the emerging champions, but that it might have been somewhat like Federer, Nadal, Djokovic in recent years? The three of you in the mix, trading off of the majors, different periods of dominance for each player. Have you ever thought about it in that way, that you might have been part of an incredible era, which had already started, and you were part of it, but it might have gone on for many years to come?
Of course. I tend to not want to think about that because it's too difficult to think about the opportunities lost. I remember Frank DeFord, well-known, famous,
yes,
famous writer and well-regarded, introducing me that way, that it could have been so different with the three of us if I had been healthy. So, yeah, I mean, without a doubt. And then I try to go straight to, thankful for what I got and how many years I had and all of that, because it really, honestly, is too painful to think about what could have been.
No, I completely understand you on that. But Tracy, in 94... at 31, you did make a brief comeback. What was behind the comeback? What were you hoping? Did you think that you were healthy enough to really maybe make a real go of it again at that stage?
Well, and that's interesting because, as you know, I was in a car accident at 25, car accident when I was playing team tennis in New Jersey,
yep,
which really I shouldn't have come through. A guy hit me. I was moving through a red light, moving through a green light, leaving my hotel. He ran through a red light at probably 60, 65 miles an hour, hit me on my side of the car on the front wheel well, which at that speed, half a second more, he would have hit my door. Just looking at pictures of the car after, there's no way, I don't even know how I escaped the accident without major injury, more major injury or death. So again, I was appreciative that I was still alive. But the comeback was something because I felt like there was unfinished business. Now, I never felt that physically because my knee was crushed, my right knee was crushed. I was out for a year. They had to do a tibia plateau. I had a tibia plateau fracture where they had to graft bone from my hip into my knee. I still have the screw to this day. My knee was never the same. It never was going to be the same. So I couldn't train as hard as I needed to. I'm one of those players that needs to be grooved, like so many players. There's a few out there that can kind of swing the racket around for an hour and a half, and they feel good. I needed 3 hours a day to feel like I could play my optimal tennis. I couldn't do that with my knee. So looking back, it wasn't the best thought out plan, but I just felt like there's unfinished business. So came back, had some decent results, but that's not ultimately where I wanted to be. And so then it was time to quit.
So, Tracy, as you look back on it all, and it was a brief, brilliant career, and that as I said, landed you in the Hall of Fame. And
it was still 7 years. I mean, a lot of people started at 20 and they finished at 27. I think we think it's more brief because it started so young.
Yeah, that's a good
it
point.
Ended so young.
Good point. But it was briefer than you would have liked, or that many of the fans would have liked. We would like to have seen it go on another decade. But is there one moment that stands out to you in that career? And was there one or two individuals that were most influential with you beyond your family that inspired you as a player?
I think it's hard to pick just one. I think obviously the U.S. Opens, we've already talked about those and how those changed my life. I think the winning Wimbledon mixed with my brother was certainly very, very special because it's not something that you dream of. It's not even on the dream-o-meter as a girl, because you just didn't ever think that that was possible. And so the fact that we had played mixed doubles, my brother John and I, the year before, we had lost to Marty Reeson and I think Wendy Turnbull pretty badly. And I said, you know, no more of that, because, you know, Marty was just all over attacking me and you know, hitting so hard. And John said, let's try one more year. And so we went out and played. We beat Newcomb and Yvonne Goolagong in an early round. And just every single match we played, we had great results, great happiness, great stories. We beat Virginia Wade and BJ Armitage along the way. We saved a match point in the final. So to win a major, to win at Wimbledon, you know, is such a special place that I had grown up dreamed of playing at with a sibling, with most of our family there, was really quite special.
Well, Tracy, now you're a parent, and you, as you mentioned, the three boys, and your son Brandon has had great success in USC. And how much have you watched him in big matches? How difficult is that? And does it make? Do you now have a better understanding what it was like for your family members and your friends to sit there biting their fingernails off during big matches that you played? How is it for you when you watch your son play?
Yeah, I'm obviously very, very nervous, and I think you're more nervous because you don't have any control. You know, on the court, you feel like the outcome, at least win or lose, it's in your hands. You know, you can give your best, whereas when you're sitting on the sidelines, you just want so much for your child to do well and for them to be happy. But he has such a great attitude out on the court. Brandon is really even-keeled. He's a great fighter. He works extremely hard. I could not be more proud. You know, he's really, I don't want to say done it on his own, because we've been there for him every step of the way, but we have not put a lot of pressure on him.
He knows what you've done, Tracy, obviously. How open is he to your advice?
Oh, my gosh. That is so funny. He doesn't want to hear a lot of advice. So that's the only frustrating part, is that, you know, whatever coach he would work with, I would talk to the coach and it would go through that channel rather than directly from me. Now, he has started to open up a little bit more because I think he recognizes that I've been there and I actually might know a thing or two about the game. So, but it's definitely been interesting because, you know, think about what he's going through. And oftentimes people say, oh, that's, you know, Tracy's son, instead of it's Brandon Holt. And so it's been a wonderful, wonderful journey. And because I've worked so much, oftentimes Scott, my husband, would take him to tournaments. But overall, I could not be more proud of him. Maybe one of my most proud moments in my life was when Brandon won the Sportsmanship Award at Kalamazoo, because that to me means so much. He's just a really good kid. And overall, he's a very happy kid and thriving in competing. He wants to play all the tournaments. He really enjoys it, and that's nice to see as a parent.
So, Tracy, it's been a great fun having this talk with you. So, at the end, I'd love to have you just comment a last time about how the U.S. Open has evolved since the days when you played first at Forest Hills and then at Flushing Meadows to becoming this incredibly prominent American sporting event. What are your final thoughts on what the U.S. Open has become on the American landscape?
Yeah, I think of it more as a commentator now, because I've commentated there now for 30 years. And I think of it as unbelievable entertainment. We have the best athletes in the world that are coming there. Everybody wants to play a night match at the U.S. Open, because as we know, that's where there's so much electricity, so much energy. You know, the fans coming in after work, they're charged up. They're mostly knowledgeable tennis fans. And those are the moments that I think that tennis players want to compete under the lights when there is that wonderful, wonderful atmosphere. And I think it's become a beautiful park. You know, Billie Jean King National Tennis Center. I couldn't be named more aptly for someone who has done so much for our sport, so much for women in sports and in general, you know, going after what she believes in. So I also think of the families that go there, that fly in from Oklahoma, from wherever, all over the country, all over the world. I think it's a great day for them because it's not only the tennis, it's the entertainment, the outside courts, you know, the food, everything about the venue is improved year after year. And so it's a great, great event.
Well, Tracy, this has been very enjoyable. I would like to tell the listeners that I, having followed a lot of commentators through the years, I think you're certainly one of the more astute analysts out there, and I know you've referred to yourself many times in self-effacingly as a student of the game, but I think you've educated a lot of viewers, and your analysis is always spot on, and I just want to let you know how impressed I've been with that, and thank you again for joining me.
Thank you, Steve. It's been wonderful.
Thank you so much to Tracy Austin for joining our very own Hall of Famer and Steve Flink, and also big thanks to Wimbledon.com's Lee Walsh for helping us wrap up the tournament. This has been episode 13 of Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. You can find us on Audioboom, on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on so much more. The U.S. Open series is upon us. It's time to turn to North America and the hard court swing. Summer tennis is here. Atlanta, San Jose, they kick us off. And then we've got so much more tennis to lead up to in celebrating 50 years of open-air tennis, 50 years of the U.S. Open. It'll all culminate Flushing Meadows in mid-September. I cannot wait. Go to usopen.org for coverage. Go to usopen.org for tickets and much more. I'm Nick McCarville. Thanks so much for listening from Center Court at Wimbledon. I bid you adieu.